This is Richard Verrone, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. John Curry. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, in the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Curry is in Madison, Alabama, and we are talking today on February 5th, 2003, at about 8:40 a.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Curry, if we could, let's start with some biographical information. Could you tell me when and where you were born, and a little bit about your childhood?
Yes, Richard. I was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi, a town of historical significance to the Civil War era.
Yes, sir.
So I have an interest in history and things like that developed from an early age. I went to high school in Vicksburg and got an appointment to the Air Force Academy to be in a second class there in 1956. And started attending the academy in Denver, Colorado at the time in 1956. Mm-hmm. And went on through the four-year program there, graduating from the new site down in Colorado Springs in 1960. So I was with the Air Force Academy class of 1960.
Okay.
During that period, they brainwashed us, you might say, a lot to think that we ought to get to be pilots. So after the academy, where I had received a navigator's rating, and of course we received our second lieutenant commissions, I went off to pilot training in Bainbridge, Georgia, and became a pilot, a military pilot. I spent what they used to call primary training for flight training in Bainbridge, Georgia, and then went to Selma, Alabama, to an old Air Force base that used to be called Craig Air Force Base, and there we did what was called basic pilot training in the T-33, and proceeded from the T-33 to Seward Air Force Base, where we learned how to fly C-130s. It was a C-130A model at the time, which was the initial type of C-130s that are still flying around a lot today.
Mm-hmm. Is flying something that you always wanted to do as a child? Was that part of your childhood?
My brother is 10 years older than I, and during the Second World War, he always had a lot of interest in airplanes. So I developed an interest in airplanes, but I had never really thought about flying. I was just interested in airplanes, and I really went to the academy because it was a free scholarship. It was something that I could do, and it wasn't that it led to flying. The academy environment led you to want to be a flyer, so I just followed that path.
Okay. Was there anyone else in your family in the military?
My father had been in World War II and retired as a colonel in the Army. He had been in the quartermaster business and support. It's about all I knew. He was in North Africa and Italy in the 5th Army, so I knew a little bit about Army stuff. And, of course, Army airplanes were part of the things that my brother had been interested in when he was my older brother. So I knew a little bit about it, but not much. Vicksburg is sort of a military town, Vicksburg, Mississippi, in the sense that the Army Corps of Engineers is there. They've been there in river control for the Mississippi River for a long time, and there's a big research and development center for the Army there. And so there's a lot of engineers and things around, mostly it's associated with the U.S. Army.
Okay. Did you talk to your father about his military experience in World War II?
I really haven't. No, I never did. I knew a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. Used to get letters from him, I recall, when I was a child. But I really didn't know much about it. A few things stick in my memory, like him saying he hated Egypt. He was in Egypt for a while. Really didn't like Egypt. But that's about one of the few memories. And he liked his general, Mark Clark, who was the commander of the 5th Army, the Army 5th Army. He was very partial to General Clark. That's about all I remember about his Army career. See him in uniform, of course, occasionally.
Right. How many other siblings did you have besides your older brother?
I had two sisters, one older, one younger.
Okay. And during your childhood, what was that like? Would you describe it as an ordinary childhood? Or
Well, I guess I would say that it was pretty ordinary. We had a small house in town while my daddy was in the Army and in World War II, and he was gone a lot. And he had worked for the Corps of Engineers and River Control before as a civil engineer, and after, when he came back from the war, he picked that job back up with the Corps as a civil engineer and worked that way till he retired. So we did okay financially, not well off or anything, but we were okay, mm-hmm. as far as I recall. And we had some property around that we raised cattle and grain and a little bit and things like that on. And so I was spending a good bit of time out in the woods and taking care of animals and gardening and things like that. I guess I think of it as a pretty normal childhood from those times.
Okay. Did your mother work at all?
She did not, no.
Okay. What kind of jobs did you have growing up?
Well, I was helping around the house and on the farm, of course. We built houses for sharecroppers at the time on the land that we had. They raised corn and cotton, and my father had about a couple hundred acres rented out to several, three or four different sharecroppers. There were houses there for them to live in. Mm-hmm. We built a couple of them and repaired them frequently, and built fence around fields, and had cows and stayed in the fence, and I would be close enough to school to walk to school in elementary school, and later he would drop me at junior high and high school, and I was reasonably involved in athletics there. We had a football team which I played on, and we did a little boxing, and we had a YMCA there, and the YMCA was a center for a lot of us kids, and we'd swim there and play basketball and other kinds of things, and so it was just a probably had a lot of friends and just grew up together and hung out together, and we all went to church together, a lot of us, the churches in town. A church was a big focal point for most of our lives.
Mm-hmm. What kind of student would you describe yourself as being?
Well, I made good grades. I was an honor roll student most of the time, and that led me to think that I could get by at the Air Force Academy when I was approached about going there. A recruiter came to our school, and he was recruiting our star All-American high school football halfback, mm-hmm. and the rest of us that were on the team that were seniors that year went to the meeting too, and I was the only one that seemed interested, and I was interested because it was like a free education, and I had the grades and things to go, so I ended up getting an appointment to go.
That's great. Did your parents emphasize education to you growing up?
They were both had at one time been teachers.
Okay.
High school teachers before I was born in the 30s. After they had gotten out of school, they had at various times taught school and been associated with teachers. Mm-hmm. But that was all before I came along. It was my brother's era, 10 years before me.
Right. What year did you graduate high school?
In 1956 was my graduation year.
Okay. What were your favorite subjects in high school?
Well, history was really important to me. I liked English. I had some good English teachers, and I did okay in math. Geometry was fun. I guess I liked all my subjects. I didn't. Civics was a good course we took. I tried to take Latin one time, and my father said, "Well, you don't need to take Latin. You ought to take mathematics and science courses." So he steered me in that direction, and that was probably a smart thing to do. I think that helped in my academy training later.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about going to the Air Force Academy. That must have been exciting, leaving Mississippi and going up to the academy.
Well, my teachers thought that was a, a bad thing to do. They weren't very encouraging.
Why did they say that?
Well, I think they were anti-military, some of them.
Okay.
That may have been wrong. It may have been they just thought that my personality was not aggressive enough to do well in the military. And for various reasons, I don't know. My father didn't really encourage me to do it. It was my idea, but he supported me when I said I wanted to do it and arranged to contact the local congressmen and senators who provided my appointment and helped me get some letters of recommendation from people around town who sent to them the nominating authorities. And that's how I ended up getting the appointment through letters of recommendation and good grades and just general interest.
How did you feel, about going to the academy? Were you really looking at your teachers who were saying maybe this is not such a good idea, John, to do this? Did you feel otherwise?
No, I was very interested in going. I didn't really care what they thought about it. One of the interests was that I didn't think that I'd be able to play college athletics, and I wanted to do that at the academy, and they had convinced us that that would be something we could do because there was only one class ahead of us. So they were playing intercollegiate sports with four-year colleges, and we only had two groups of two classes. So, and that worked out that way. All the time I was at the academy, first 3 years, I played football and boxed and did the intramural program, a couple other kinds of sports, and it was a very sports-oriented 4 years that I spent in Colorado.
What position did you play on the football team?
Well, I guess defense was my prime goal. I played linebacker, and I was a center for a while, and I played end and defensive mostly. Played a little guard, did a little blocking, and for running backs, and actually I played and I banged up a knee and had to have knee surgery the second year, and after knee surgery I went back, but I wasn't ever really successful anymore. It just funny thing about those kinds of things that other things took on more importance than football after that knee surgery.
Right. How did you adapt to the military lifestyle there at the academy?
Well, it didn't seem to bother me. It was strict. It was different. But my parents had taught me to maintain things in an orderly manner and think in that way. And so people wanting me to be orderly and direct in the things I did wasn't a big change, really. I'm sure I wrote a lot of letters home and talked about how terrible it was, but so did everybody else. So I guess it was not an unusual transition. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things I think that did happen was because I was from Mississippi, I was rooming with a guy from Chicago, and our commandant of cadets, was a brigadier general, came into our room one time. There were two of us in the room, and asked us, he was just inspecting, and he asked us where we were from, and he really liked my roommate, because he was from Chicago, and when he heard I was from Mississippi, he said, well, you probably won't be around here very long. Education in Mississippi wasn't something that he figured was worth enough or was good enough to get anybody through, but I never had any trouble with grades there. I had good schools in Vicksburg because of all the engineering orientation in the town.
Mm-hmm. So was that general joking, or was he serious?
Oh, no, I'm sure he was dead serious. He figured nobody from Mississippi would be able to make the cut grade-wise at the academy. And he just generalized a little too much, probably.
Right. Did you take that upon yourself as a challenge?
Well, I think so.
So you adapted fairly well to the military lifestyle, and you did okay academically?
That seems good. I was in the top quarter of the class all the way through, and there were a lot of people there who had, a couple of them had already graduated from college and decided they wanted to go to the academy, so they went back after they'd already graduated. And there were a lot of I was one of the younger cadets, I guess, since I'd just gotten out of high school, and there were a lot of them there who had been 1, 2, 3, and up to 4 years of college already.
Mm-hmm. Once you had gotten out of the academy, did you look back on it and think that the training had been beneficial to you, or was it something that really did prepare you for the regular military lifestyle?
Oh, I think it was excellent preparation in every way. They were strongly encouraging us throughout those years to continue our education, and we did. After we got out, we expected to come back to school, and I probably wouldn't have stayed in the Air Force if they hadn't sent me back to get a master's degree in later years after my service in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But it adapted well, and it served me well then and all the way till now.
Okay. Well, tell me about your decision to become a pilot.
Well, I really hadn't ever thought about doing that, but of course, being in the Air Force, they kind of took it for granted that everybody that was physically qualified would go to pilot training at that time, and so I just kind of went along, and it seemed like that would be fun. In the navigator training we had during the academy days, it was okay. It wasn't anything I was particularly doing without learning how to fly as a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
But we did, and we got commissioned, and then it was time to go to pilot training. And like most of the things the military seems to do, you just kind of follow along as they tell you, and that was the way it went.
Well, tell me about Bainbridge, Georgia, and the pilot training experience.
Well, Bainbridge, we flew two airplanes. We started off in a little T-34, which was a two-seater back in front, and we had civilian instructors at Bainbridge, so they were very strict and didn't put up with any kind of foolishness, and that was the way the civilian instructors were in those days. So they chewed us out regularly and hollered at us and made us learn how to fly. And that wasn't hard on us because we had that for 4 years at the academy, so it just kind of came natural that was a fine thing to do. And we had all of our academy friends mostly were down there along with some other people, and we enjoyed being down in southern Georgia for about a six-month training period. Learned how to fly that, and then we ended up flying the T-37, which was the new first jet-powered trainer, for a small bit of time before we left and went off to basic pilot training, where we were flying old jet fighters. It used to be the F-80, Lockheed F-80 Shooting Star that they reworked as a T-33.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that the first time down in Bainbridge that you had actually flown an airplane yourself, piloted an airplane?
Yes, that was the first time. I hadn't any training doing that. We didn't do that at the academy.
Okay.
Actually piloting ourselves. Some people had flown before and had private licenses, but not very many of us. Most of us were just new to the business.
Mm-hmm. What was that experience like, your first time flying, piloting yourself?
Well, it was a lot of fun. It was a challenge. It didn't seem like it was very hard. You kind of moved the control. It wasn't unlike driving. It was hot in Bainbridge, so we frequently opened slid the canopy back and flew open cockpit, which was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it was exciting. It was a lot of fun.
Did flying come naturally to you, or is this something that you really had to challenge yourself to learn?
Well, I really had to get down to business and learn how to do that. It wasn't a natural thing to me, and I had a little trouble doing that. Flying made me sick.
And, really?
So I had a lot of air sickness during my training and all through my flight careers, even though I ended up with 4,000 flying hours. And
wow.
If I wasn't careful, I could get sick in an airplane.
Hmm. What did you do to counter that?
Well, at various times, as a cadet, when we used to fly places, we'd go back in the back of the airplanes where we were, and I'd go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to where I could sleep on an airplane, no matter how noisy or shaky or cold it was.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I generally didn't have much trouble. I had just had to be careful about it.
Right.
And that let me get through pilot training. And after that, it wasn't too bad. After you flying in the front, where you're driving is great.
Mm-hmm.
Sickness comes when you're flying in the back or standing up watching people do things. Your attention, I guess your body's attention goes somewhere else, and then mm-hmm. when that happens, it's easy to get sick.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What other training did you have in Bainbridge besides the pilot? Was that almost exclusively that?
It was really pretty much exclusively that. We had a lot of ground school courses and things. They were mostly about flying, and we learned Morse code and other things, radio procedures and things that kind of dealt with flying, too. So it wasn't much of there. Of course, we had physical training, too. So we played sports and that various kinds of games and stuff and ran and did a little marching. And, you know, it wasn't unlike what the typical military situation is in any camp anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And from there, you went to Selma, Alabama?
That's right.
Okay.
And Selma was basic. We flew the T-33, and we were there for about 6 months again. And got out as fully qualified pilots. We got our commercial licenses, most of us, and with instrument ratings, and I kept that and used it all the way up until just recently when I decided flying wasn't fun anymore, so I didn't do it. Besides, it costs too much now.
What other training did you have there in Selma? Was it basic?
At Selma, we did basic. We learned how to fly instruments, and we flew formation, and learned how to fly formation, and we learned how to fly cross country, and how to navigate. Of course, we already knew how to navigate since I was a rated navigator. But doing it as a pilot is a little bit different. And learned how to file flight plans and do all the paperwork associated with weight and balance and keeping track of everything you need to know to fly correctly. And that served me well when I moved on to Smyrna, Tennessee, to Seward Air Force Base was the name, and that's closed now too. It's now a big Saturn plant, I guess, up there at that place. So, that was a very good transition up to flying a big four-engine airplane from a small jet fighter.
Right. Before we move to your C-130 training, was there any outstanding incidents that you remember from Bainbridge or being in Selma about the training, anything that comes to memory?
Well, one thing, I guess, they always pay you hazardous duty pay when you fly, and all of these schools, both at Bainbridge and at Selma, you know, there would be crashes and people would get killed, and that happened both at Bainbridge several times and at Craig several times. So there was always things to keep us advised that this wasn't play. This was serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, guys that I knew in training in both bases had crashed and been killed, both instructors and students.
Mm-hmm. Did that deter you at all from what you were trying to do?
No. I always think of yourself as not in danger at all. You just press on and do that. It wasn't. Never thought of it being something that might happen to me. Never really crossed my mind.
Okay.
That's strange to say, but it didn't.
Well, tell me about transitioning to the C-130. How different was it from flying the small fighter planes?
Well, they prepared us real well for the big aircraft. When I finally got up and got in the big airplane, we flew around a lot and found out it was easy to land and had wonderful instruments and very stable and get a little control of the airspeed and you can do just about anything. And we found out the mission was to go drop things out the back of it. And so my first mission was out to Yuma, California, Yuma, Arizona, I guess it was. And we went out. It's still, even today, an airdrop test facility there where you go out and you practice dropping things. We were testing parachutes and heavy equipment drops. So we did a lot of drops out the back of the airplane in Yuma and had a good time on the ground and went to Mexico. And it was a fun trip. It was say, no, no, this is great. Air Force is going to be a fun life.
How did you come to be in the C-130? Why didn't you continue with the smaller planes?
Well, in pilot training in those days, they, according to your class rank, you got to pick what you would what you wanted to be in. And since I had some issues about flying, and I wasn't high in my class in flying skills, mm-hmm. I did okay and I passed and everything. But the grades a number of other people got were probably somewhat better. I was probably down in the lower quarter of that class, and the top ranking guys got fighters and bombers, got combat aircraft.
Right.
And became instructors and training. And the lower ranked people in the classes ended up in transport airplanes.
Okay.
And so that's why I ended up in a transport airplane.
Okay. Do you have any regrets about that looking back?
Oh, absolutely not. I got the better deal. I wouldn't have swapped that for anything.
Why do you say it's a better deal?
Well, I think we had more fun in our flight career doing things and going places than the fighter guys. And the bomber guys, as far as I was concerned, were the worst off. And the training people were always envious of us because they never got out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, the transport in the 130 particularly, some of my friends went into regular reciprocating engine aircraft,
mm-hmm.
that were still prevalent at the time. And the 130 was a wonderful airplane. I don't think it had a great mission. So it worked out for me to be absolutely the best.
Okay, that's great. Tell me about the 130. What made it such a good airplane?
Well, it was, it could fly. It was the first transport that really could fly at decent altitudes. The others were flying in the low altitude structure, and they had to fly through all the weather, and they were slow. But the 130 was pretty fast, and it could fly up above most of the clouds. And you'd take off in the cloudy, ugly day and pop out on top, and, you know, at 7, 8, 12, 15, 20, 25, 30,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
occasionally. And you'd fly around in beautiful weather up there and fly around the tops of clouds instead of having to fly through them, which made it just really fun to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very forgiving airplane. It had wonderful control. And still does today. It's a great airplane even today.
So after you finished your training there, well, you said this was 6 months?
6 months at Bainbridge, and then we went off to Smyrna for C-130s. And
right.
We trained in the units in those days. They later established schools to train people in new aircraft, but we were unit trained there. And the unit did the missions and trained us as a part of the mission.
Okay.
So I did airdrops, and we would frequently go to Fort Bragg and Fort Benning to drop troops over Army troops there, and
mm-hmm.
And we learned how to do things, going and actually doing it.
Right, right.
I wasn't at Smyrna very long. I was only there 6 months, and it was 1963,
mm-hmm.
and they sent our whole wing to support the increasing issues in Southeast Asia,
mm-hmm.
and they sent our whole wing to out to Naha Air Base, Okinawa.
Okay. This was in 63.
Did I put that in my questionnaire? I'm not sure if I...
Yes, you did.
Did that. I think 63 is the right... It should have been about April of 63.
Okay. Tell me what you knew at that point about what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia.
Well, I really didn't know much. And as I recall, things were... It was a part of the world, and there were things going on there, but I guess I didn't really know much about it. I kept track of geopolitical scene pretty much. I had thought that I might really enjoy being in politics or in political science kind of things and diplomatic things, but, you know, so I was really excited about going overseas, but I didn't know much about what they were doing in Vietnam at the time. We were being sent to Okinawa, so I didn't really connect the two.
Right, right. So this is with the 345th?
Yes.
Troop Carrier Squadron in
yes.
Okinawa. Tell me what your duties were there in Okinawa.
Well, we got to Okinawa, and everybody was there unaccompanied for a while till they found housing. It was so we We spent most of our time were thinking about flying and learning how to play racquetball and playing handball and keeping in shape and running and just paying attention to those kinds of individual concerns. We spent a lot of time in the squadron area learning about the aircraft and all the things that one does to support an aircraft unit, worrying about intelligence briefings and personal equipment issues, and it was a busy time.
And didn't do much flying at the time?
We were flying about 20 hours a month was what we were mostly doing, and we might get one or two trips down to the Philippines or somewhere in a month. Did a lot of local flying, dropping practice loads in Okinawa and out over the water, flying formation mostly at the time, and it was really interesting flying over the Black Ocean and formation at night. It was really dark out there.
Mm-hmm. How was that for you?
Well, it was a challenge. There were a number of us in the same situation. We probably had 10 or 12 new pilots came in about the same time I did, so we were all learning to do that and learning to do everything else about the same time. So it was quite a group of folks. We had a lot of fun together and got to know each other well, and it was a good time.
Okay. And how long did you stay there in Okinawa?
That tour in Okinawa lasted for 3 years. That was the tour length.
Okay.
We started mostly just flying local occasional missions to the Philippines. Typhoons, we hit Okinawa occasionally. We'd fly up to Korea generally to get away from them, and did a little flying in Japan, not a lot. Went to Hong Kong a couple of times, Taiwan. Occasionally we'd fly into Bangkok or Saigon, but not very often in those days. The longer we were there, the more we ended up flying into Saigon and Bangkok because things were heating up down in the Southeast Asia area.
Right.
And there were troops moving in there, and we were carrying them in there and bringing them out and taking them supplies. And we used to carry a lot of radio gears and truck radio gear and trucks that had radio equipment on them and stuff for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably how they got a lot of it in there to begin with.
When was the first time you actually flew into Saigon? Do you remember?
No, I really don't. It was probably in 63, late 63.
Mm-hmm.
And then regularly after that, I probably was into Saigon and Bangkok every month or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably in my records where that was, but I don't remember, except to know that we went down there a good bit, and the longer we stayed there, the more time we spent down there.
Right, right. Did you ever stay overnight there?
Yes, we did. As a matter of fact, we'd stay overnight, and we generally would stay in those days, in the early days, in the Majestic Hotel, which was an old French hotel downtown Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Rooms were cheap, and they came with breakfast and dinner. So it seems like $15 was the per diem, and that covered breakfast and dinner. So it was pretty good.
Tell me what your impressions were of Vietnam itself.
Well, it was a smelly place. Had a lot of people, and we'd fly in. The people seemed friendly, and where we were, we'd occasionally fly into other places, but we always spent the night in Saigon in those days. And the country was pretty country. There were a lot of Chinese people there, not just Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting figuring out how to distinguish or different various kinds of Oriental Asiatic people. I would have lumped them all together before I was stationed there, but the Japanese in Okinawa and the Chinese and Vietnamese that we ran into, and the Thais and from when we would fly into Bangkok, and the Filipinos that we'd see in the Philippines, and the Koreans that we'd see when we were in Korea, we were really finding out what all the different Asiatic peoples were like there. It was an interesting time for that.
What were your impressions of Saigon itself?
Well, Saigon was busy. There was a lot of things going on down there. We would see a lot of Army troops driving around in jeeps, and they obviously were worried about protection because most of the doorways were sandbagged, and in case some, and they were generally manned by Vietnamese police and with weapons, and
mm-hmm.
they were trying to protect everybody, and I guess I guess that period, I must have been down there when they had the Tet Offensive was a big thing in Vietnam, and we were there at the time. I just don't remember what year that was.
That was in late January 1968.
Okay, I was back over there then. That was
okay.
My second tour over there then.
Okay.
That wasn't in this tour.
Okay. Were you aware of some of the political things that were happening in South Vietnam in 63 with the overthrow of Ngo Dinh Diem and the coup d'etat and then, of course, Kennedy's death? And
well, we were there, and I must have been there when Kennedy was shot. When that was 63?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was over there when that happened. I spent all this time over in Southeast Asia during the 60s and didn't really get hard. It wasn't in the States hardly at all until 69. At least it seems like that, and didn't witness much going on in the States. So you're pretty. We had our forces radio and television over there some in those days, but not a lot. And you know, we saw a few things on television. The papers were few and far between, and we didn't read them very often. So you know, we were really kind of isolated from U.S. Things that were going on in the continental United States at the time, and things that were going on politically in the world.
Mm-hmm. Those first initial missions in the Saigon, do you remember what you were carrying in there? You mentioned radios and trucks with radios, and then the American troops are going to start coming in mass in 65. But what were you initially carrying in there?
Well, we... I think comm gear was the principal thing. We generally would have a big connex of some kind in the back, and it would be a self-contained unit full of stuff. We didn't really know what was in it. Most of the time, I think it must have been some kind of generally communications gear and parts of radar systems and things like that. I don't think there weren't a lot of U.S. troops in Vietnam at the time, so we, I think they were mostly supplied probably via ship. We weren't carrying things like commissary goods and weapons and ammunition and things like that, like we did carry later on in the second tour. We spent a lot of time carrying stuff like that,
right?
Carrying howitzer shells and carrying body bags and.
Mm-hmm.
And things, because there were so many more people over there, and the combat was so much more over there at second in the 66, 67 time frame.
Right.
But early on, we seems like we were carry helicopter blades occasionally,
mm-hmm.
big repair parts for helicopters. They had helicopters over there at the time early, and their parts were high value items that would be transported by air.
Mm-hmm. Were you doing drops in Vietnam, or were you mainly landing at Tan Son Nhut and Saigon, offloading?
We didn't do any drops over there. I never did. In the first tour I was there, we did some practice drops to mm-hmm. keep people, paratrooper qualified later, but I never did any combat drops as such.
Okay.
We practiced a lot, dropping containers and things, and I know other people probably did drops, but I'd never do any drops over there that were combat drops.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the C-130 and your crew. How many were on board with you?
Well, we would have a loadmaster or two, sometimes two, a flight engineer who would take care of the systems and fuel and electrics and panels, and then we would have a navigator and two pilots. So.
Okay.
That would be a crew of five, and occasionally there would be an instructor with a student in training,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes there might be three pilots, but for the same kind of reason. But generally, there were crews of five.
Okay. And were you when you flew into Saigon and these other cities, were you flying in, you know, was it one plane, or were you in formation with a number of planes?
Well, these were all, these support missions were generally always one plane.
Okay.
There might be more than one plane headed out, but they generally fly, they might take off like an hour apart from And our missions from Okinawa, we generally stage through the Philippines and through Clark Air Base. So we typically fly from Okinawa down to Clark in the Philippines, spend the night, and then we fly the next day over to Vietnam and drop off something and bring some stuff back to Clark and then back to Okinawa. And that was a typical mission. Occasionally we'd go into Taiwan, but not very often.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things would you bring back out of Vietnam?
A lot of times in those days, there were just people, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
There would be people coming to survival school. They had a survival school at Clark, so we'd rotate people in and out of Vietnam that were coming back for R&R, for various kinds of reasons. Generally not permanent change of station orders, because they would fly those on civilian airliners out of Saigon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Explain to me how you go about dropping something out of the 130. You said you've talked about practicing this a lot. Is there an art to this?
Well, you know, it's really a crew coordination event. Whatever you're going to drop, if it's people, the Army would be Army people, and our combat controllers people, and there would be a person in charge in the back who would work with our loadmaster to make sure everybody was hooked up or sat in the right spots and connected up and equipment checked them. And if it was heavy equipment, then loadmaster would be the one in charge, and he'd do the same kind of thing to make sure the heavy equipment was properly loaded. But then we'd take off and fly an appropriate route, and we might be going fast at low level or fast at high level to get there. And when the time came, we would find an entry point to the drop zone pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd fly a pattern that put us at the right altitude to drop. Heavy equipment and troopers were dropped from different altitudes depending on their capabilities and other kinds of things. And had to be very sensitive of wind, because the wind, if it was real strong, it'd be too strong to drop. It could destroy the equipment or kill the troops. So had to worry about the wind on the ground. We generally found that out from somebody down there that would call us and tell us what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And our navigator would lead us in to a lot for the wind, so we'd try to hit the drop point. And we'd slow down to the proper speed and turn on the red light and slow down so everybody could see in the back that we were getting close, and that the red meant don't jump when the doors are opened. And then we'd open the doors and fly the rest of the way in until the time to drop came, and which time the co-pilot would flip on the green light. And when the green light meant, okay, it's time to go.
Mm-hmm.
If they were troopers, they would start exiting on the green light, because they were standing in the door waiting. And if it was heavy equipment, then frequently the co-pilot would push a button in front, and it would cause a parachute to go out the back, and the parachute would extract a big parachute, which would pull the load out and then support it as the load went onto the ground if it was heavy equipment drop. There were some other kinds of drops, too, some low-altitude package drops and things, but most of what we were doing was personnel or heavy equipment.
Okay. What kind of intelligence briefings did you get before you would go on these missions?
Well, generally, they would always try to brief you on intelligence before you would go off from Okinawa on one of these missions. And the missions I flew were pretty standard. There was, you know, they'd tell you a little bit about the current threat conditions in Saigon, and that there were people around that would try to get you into places, and you know, but we, nobody, no crew I was ever aware of was ever involved in any incidents in Saigon in this time frame.
Okay.
We lost a few crews to weather and bad piloting, and a few people came back with bullets in their airplanes, but not very many in the 63 to 65 time frame.
Right. Were you ever shot at during that time period?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. How did you feel flying into a war zone? How did that affect you as a pilot?
Well, I didn't really. I knew it was a war zone, but it didn't really. You know, I didn't feel any more unsafe flying there than I did flying into Bangkok or the Philippines. Generally, we didn't fly into smaller fields. Most of the time, there were two or three fields that we flew into, but they were big fields.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were people who met us on the ground, and we had radio contact with everybody. And it wasn't much of a war over there from our point of view in those days.
Right. So after, when 1965, do you leave Okinawa? Or what do you do?
Well, in 65, I left and went back to the States. I was stationed at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, still flying C-130s. And got back there, and as it turned out, I thought I would be there for quite a while. That was the way things went those days. But they sent me to Squadron Officer School in Montgomery, Alabama in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back from that, I already had orders to go back to the Philippines this time instead of Okinawa, and as a unit. They were going to send our whole unit back over there again. So I didn't spend very long in the States. That was actually a little bit less than a year, probably.
Okay. What did they teach you at Squadron Officer School? What were you learning there?
Well, it was a basic training program to make us aware of what was going on in the world, and we studied various countries a little bit and how the Air Force was organized and how it had changed in organization structure some, and how it planned on using its junior officers. I guess I was a captain at the time I went there, and we had captains and lieutenants in our class, and we met and In a class of, I guess we must have had 10 or 12 people in a class, and
mm-hmm.
had an instructor who stayed with us and taught us things. We did a lot of sports activities together. That was a big part of the program. We had a chorus that sang. It was a school-like atmosphere. And,
mm-hmm.
We had a lot of parties with our families, our wives, and everything got together. And
mm-hmm.
And that was all part of building camaraderie, as was part of the goals of the school.
Right. When had you gotten married?
I had gotten married on the way to Smyrna after basic pilot training in 63.
Okay.
61, actually.
Did your wife accompany you to Okinawa?
She did. She was there. We got there, and the families weren't allowed to come for 6 months till we had housing, but She joined me in Okinawa after I had been there for about 6 months, and spent the rest of the 3 years there, and then went to Langley with me when I came back to the States.
How did she feel about you flying in a war zone there during your first tour?
Well, she was happy to be in Okinawa after spending 6 months living with her parents, and I didn't feel threatened in any way. I don't think she did either. We didn't think of that as being a threatening situation at the time.
Okay. So when you go back over to Southeast Asia, you go to Clark in the Philippines, and...
Well, we didn't really go to Clark.
We
went to a place called Cebu down in the central Philippines. They opened up a new base, and it was a bare base kind of place. It didn't have any buildings. It was an open field, and they set up a bunch of tents. So we moved into tents in 1966.
Wow.
And figured we'd be there for a year, and we were. And our families were all back in the States. They didn't, any of them, get to come over.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started really flying seriously when we got down there, because things were heating up over in Vietnam. And our mission there was to support things in Southeast Asia, but we weren't stationed there from various kinds of reasons. They couldn't send any more troops over there, and so we would fly over to Vietnam and Saigon most of the time for 2 weeks at a time. We'd fly over there for 2 weeks, and then we'd fly back to Cebu, back to the Philippines. And Cebu was a very interesting place. It was old Filipino time. All the kids would run around and give you the V for victory, like from MacArthur's days. And they all remembered MacArthur and the end of World War II, and they were very pro-American there. And we really enjoyed being there. It was a true South Seas kind of place. Wonderful clear water and reefs full of fish, and it was an island off of Cebu. Was an island where we were stationed, was an island off the coast of the city of Cebu, just a mile or so. But it was a really a beautiful location, isolated somewhat, but but beautiful. And
you lived in tents the entire time.
They right toward the end, they finally had built some concrete block barracks that we moved into just before I left. And they were upgrading the place, and I guess they must have kept people there. I don't know how long they kept the base open before they gave it back to the Filipinos, but it turned out later to really be one of the top bases in the Philippine Air Force.
Where else besides Saigon would you fly in Vietnam?
Well, we would fly regularly into Da Nang and Chulai and Cameron Bay and and then, of course, all the small places around. From there, we'd fly to Bangkok and Korat and Udorn and Ubon and the bases that were over in Thailand. And those were mostly where we flew to. Once we got over in country on one of those two-week tours, then we would we were working 12 hours on and 12 hours off. So we'd go fly for 12 hours and come down and take 12 hours off and then be scheduled to fly again. So we were really doing a lot of flying.
Were your flights mainly during the daytime?
No, they were around the clock.
Okay.
And there were probably more in the day than were at night, but they were around really around the clock. And you'd kind of actually, the 12 hours off might be 15. You'd find out what it was. They couldn't fly earlier than 12 hours. And so you kind of rotated through the schedule for the 2 weeks you were flying over there in country. And we'd fly into all the small fields, and there we were taking people around and hauling ammunition and parts for helicopters and food. We did a lot of food hauling. And all kinds. Generally, there was all kinds of loads just waiting to go somewhere.
What was the most interesting thing you think you hauled?
Well, it was interesting hauling ammunition, hauling howitzer shells, and they were pretty heavy, so you didn't fill the airplane up. They were all loaded on pallets, so you'd run in and into Saigon, and they'd zip five pallets on your airplane and lock them in, and you'd take off.
Did you so you never even got out of the airplane?
Well, generally we would. We'd get out of the airplane, but we'd take off and and go somewhere and drop the stuff off, and it'd generally take 45 minutes or so to turn around, and so we'd all generally get out of the airplane. We generally didn't do it. We weren't in any rush about doing it.
Right. Tell me about the different bases, Da Nang, Chulai, Cameron, that you would fly into.
Well, they were all initially they were all small bases, but they were all being developed. So there was always a lot of construction going on, and where we might land at one time, it would be just a PSP airfield, Pierce planking, kind of metal planking that they put down on a temporary airfield, and then next thing you know, they'd cover it over with rubber. They had these rubber, quarter-inch rubber sheets that they put on the prepared surface so you could land on that. And next thing you know, it'd be concrete. It'd be 10,000 feet long. We were doing a lot of construction over there at the time. And they would do the 10,000 feet runways so they could bring in fighters to that place. And then next thing, it'd be F-100s there, or later F-4s or other or F-105s or other kinds of airplanes.
Were you always staying in Saigon? Was that your base, or would you spend the night at Cam Ranh or at?
No, we always very seldom did we ever stay anywhere other than Saigon. Or occasionally we stayed in Bangkok, but most of the missions they brought everything into Saigon and we loaded it in Saigon and we'd pick it up at Saigon and fly around, drop it off, and terminate back in Saigon.
Okay.
Occasionally, I can remember once or twice I was sent out to be the person on the ground at a small field while a bunch of airplanes came in. We generally would do that. And you'd fly in with the first one and then stay on the ground, helping them, everybody get everything squared away, and then you'd fly out with the last guy.
Okay.
So if you didn't have some reason you didn't catch the last guy out, you might spend the night in the place you didn't really want to be.
Mm-hmm.
But Saigon was basically the place where everybody stayed.
Did you still have, did you go to stay in town when you spent the night, or did you have barracks on
No, we we always stayed in hotels downtown.
Okay.
Initially, in the early days, it was the Majestic Hotel, because that was one of the few that was there.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, they opened a lot of hotels, so we had several places that we would go. Used to really enjoy their hotels there, and not that they were wonderful places, but the food in Saigon was great.
Mm-hmm.
French cuisine was wonderful. We'd eat in good places and walk around and find things downtown to do, and it was a fun place to be.
What would you do for entertainment?
Well, we generally would go to bars and we'd eat and go shopping. They had markets down there where they sold different kinds of things, and they had a lot of bookstores and various things that were made by the primitive tribes there, things made out of brass and things made out of wood and things made out of leather, and there were a lot of things to look at, a lot of some stuff pretty fancy, some of it pretty primitive, but interesting.
What did you think of the Vietnamese civilians?
They were didn't really interact much with them. Now, they seemed competent. Most of them spoke French, and we didn't. So, and then they would learn to speak English, but they didn't interact much with the Vietnamese.
Okay.
The whole time I was there, for a long time, but I really didn't do much interacting with them.
Why not?
Well, it just didn't. We were busy, and we were on military installations or riding in trucks or something, and
right.
We just didn't connect with the Vietnamese very much.
Are there any outstanding incidents that come to mind in the 66-67 tour? Things that happened to the airplane or to other crews?
Well, one thing I might mention, I ran into, for a very big surprise to me, I ran into a friend I'd been to high school with.
Really?
He was a civilian, but he had gone to work for the Army in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army that he was working for was the Army that built airfields,
right?
The Corps of Engineers, and he was over there working on some airfield building, and we just saw each other and were really shocked. And we were in an officers' club in Saigon, and eating, and so we got together and had a good time there for that day. And still, he and I talk about it when we see each other. I go back to Mississippi sometime, and. He lives there now. He's retired from the Corps of Engineers, and I'm retired from the Air Force, so we have fun getting together talking about this occasionally.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. During this tour, were you ever shot at?
The second tour, we picked up a few bullet holes flying up in the northern part of South Vietnam, into Hue, I think, is where we noticed them.
Mm-hmm.
We were flying into Khe Sanh and some of the places up there where there was a lot of activity, and we found a couple of bullet holes once or twice. We didn't know it till we got on the ground, but our flight engineer's task was to check the airplane over thoroughly every time we landed, and he said, "Oh, we got a couple of bullet holes out there in the wing this time." So there were a few instances of having problems like that.
What do you remember most about flying in that combat zone?
Well, we were not under positive control. Nobody really knew where you were. There wasn't good radars around very much, so you would fly, and you might fly through clouds, and you didn't know if there was anybody else in the cloud or not. You know, you went where you're supposed to go and did the best you could to get there, and once you got there, you had instrument approaches to help you land, but control in the flights was eyeballs only.
Wow.
A lot of times you were in clouds or around clouds, and you could see fighters making passes below you because you were generally above all of the low traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice to be in a 130 for that, because we were up where there wasn't many other people flying around, and the weather was better up at higher altitude.
Right. Are there any close calls that you can remember having?
Well, we probably had a lot of them we didn't know about.
Maybe that was for the better.
Yeah. but weather was always an interesting thing. I can remember landing, coming into Saigon, and there was a big front on one end of the field. We were rapidly approaching from the other end of the field, and we got on the ground just as the front hit. You know, it's one of these things where you can see this big line of black, ugly black clouds,
mm-hmm.
and you know you don't want to be flying when it gets there, particularly low to the ground. So we were racing to get on the ground, and the front was racing just coming in at the other end of the runway. So we landed, and then this big terrible wind storm and rain hit, but we got on the ground just ahead of it.
Okay.
Got to slow down before it caught us. We had a lot of fun with the weather, and I can remember seeing a small airplane about 200 yards off our wing as we were coming into an airfield there at Tonsnut one time. And it was the same altitude we were, flying in the opposite direction, so he must have been lost. He wouldn't have been there. But I didn't really have any close calls with airplanes that we knew about like that. A few. But weather was always more challenging than the traffic.
Right. As pilot, I guess you were considered the leader of your crew.
That's right, yeah.
Your plane. Tell me about your leadership skills and how they developed in Vietnam.
Well, it was interesting to start when you first fly. You're in a multi-engine airplane like that. You're the co-pilot. So your chief pilot is the leader, and you learn your leadership skills that you use later on from him. So you spend 2 or 3 years flying with somebody, and you see what they do and how they do it. And when your turn comes and you've been trained to be the pilot, and then you have a co-pilot, then you train your co-pilot as you were trained and let him do things and learn how to do things, and he watches you. So it's kind of a growth issue.
Okay.
You have good group of people that you can model after, and you do that based on, and you add to it your particular orientation that you've seen and been trained in the academy and other places, and it really comes out pretty good.
So you were comfortable in that position?
Oh, very much so. My flying skills, because I was flying a lot, were really very good at the time. So I was very comfortable with teaching new pilots or co-pilots and how to fly, and I was an instructor pilot at this time.
Okay.
And I was had a lot of experience, and the enlisted guys were good friends and good guys, and we all worked together as a good team. It really worked out very 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 good.
What about the other leadership? Maybe talk about your supervisors, the people who were above you, and then the overall military leadership in Vietnam.
Well, our majors and colonels at the time, I was a captain. I wrote a paper one time on what a good leader our squadron commander was while I was at... I guess while I was at SOS, this must have been the squadron commander I can't remember who was who now, but our lieutenant colonel leadership and wing leadership was really good. You know, they were with us all the time. They knew what we were doing. They did it themselves occasionally, and they were educated people. They could listen to you, and they could give you direction. They didn't seem to be ambivalent about the way they would do things. There was a lot of concern, though, about the kind of military leadership we were getting, because it was clear that we were under tight constraints on how we were fighting the war.
Even to you guys who were in the 130s.
Okay. Yes, and we sent our operations officer off one time to a ground job there in Vietnam, and and he said, I was watching this. I knew that this enemy convoy was supplying them up in north part of the country, and we had fighters we could have sent up there and blown them up, but we couldn't get approval to send them up, and we knew they were going to get all these guns and kill all our people up there. And, you know, there was a lot of, you could tell that there was a lot of things that we were doing that were just pure stupidity, even from the point I was in. When I came back after that, I didn't want to have anything to do with those kinds of folks anymore. I figured that our president at the time was an absolute anathema. I I would have never voted for him again. I was glad when he lost his office. This was LBJ.
Right. What about the military leadership in Vietnam? I mean, you know.
I what I saw over there seemed okay. One of the colonels over there, when I was at the Air Force Academy, had gotten promoted to general. He was a 2 or 3 star general, and I knew him real well.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd see him over in the Saigon Club all the time, and I felt like we had excellent leadership. I always really liked him. I thought he was a great leader at the academy and later as a general. And I thought our military leadership was just fine. I didn't have any reason to criticize them at all.
Right.
But I attributed the problems that I saw over there to the civilian leadership.
Okay. Were you questioning whether there should be civilian leadership of the military, or did you think we simply needed more competent people in the civilian leadership?
Well, I guess the training suggested that always the civilians were in charge of everything, and the military was supposed to advise them and help them figure out how to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought our military guys were pretty good and must be doing that, so then it must be the civilian guy's fault if it didn't come out right.
Right.
So I attributed our problems over there to the civilian leadership.
Okay. Had your attitude toward the war changed? I mean, you obviously were becoming more and more aware of the actual war, what was going on, the politics involved, the military movements involved.
Well, I guess most military people are trained to win, to feel that you're supposed to go win wars.
Mm-hmm.
And if something interferes with what you think you need to do to win, then there must be, the civilian guys must be messing it up.
Okay.
So, or not doing it right. So, we thought it shouldn't have been a big problem to go win the war over there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, we were being impeded by civilian limitations that we didn't think were reasonable.
Mm-hmm. What do you think could have been done differently?
Well, there seemed to be to us to be little reason not to attack things that we knew that were coming in to support the fight in South Vietnam. So the idea that China was going to drop nuclear bombs on us because of a war in Indonesia, into China, or in Hanoi or anywhere else, is just didn't make sense to me. You know, we should have probably bombed Russian ships in the harbor. Then there wouldn't have been Russian ships up there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And not, they wouldn't have attacked us in the United States because of that.
Mm-hmm.
They would have quit supporting these guys. And those were all political limitations that we had at certain times. And later on in the war, we got to where we were more inclined to bomb people up north and stop inputs of things into the country in the north, which came down and hurt us in the south. So.
Right.
I guess I guess I've always thought there wasn't the limitations we placed on ourselves about bombing up in the north were not very good, not very reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever fly into Laos?
We flew over Laos regularly for a long time, mm-hmm. only at altitude, though.
Okay.
There was a regular airway that flew over from Vietnam over Laos into Thailand, and we would make that generally at 20,000 feet or above.
Right.
And so we did it regularly, but we never got low until we were in Thailand.
Mm-hmm. You never had any drop missions in Laos?
No.
Okay. Tell me about, you mentioned earlier that you would carry body bags occasionally.
Well, that's one of the jobs, and we'd go into the little fields, and there was a lot of combat activity around some of these small fields. And mm-hmm. A lot of times we'd carry in food or shells and come back out with body bags and mm-hmm. troops. And particularly it was true up in Hue and Khe Sanh and in the northern part of the country. It was a lot hotter up there than it was in the southern part.
Did you guys think about that very much, or how did it affect you?
Well, we didn't stay around it. Those were things that the loadmasters dealt with, and when we did that, we didn't go back in the back of the cargo compartment. We let that. We'd see those things on the pallets on the ramps, mm-hmm. and we knew we were carrying them, but we didn't dwell in the area or think about it much.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea was really we would put it out of our mind, just go fly.
Right. Where was the most dangerous place in Vietnam where you would fly into?
Well, I guess a couple of instances. We flew into a little place called Song Bi one time and blew a tire. So we had to stay on the runway for repairs, and it took us 6 or 7 hours there. And they always claimed that was a very hot activity, so we were expecting to be mortared at any time, and didn't. We got our tire changed and took off, and 6 or 7 hours later,
mm-hmm.
and it was one of those things you worry about. You're fixing to get attacked, but we never did. We flew into a little airfield in the middle of a rubber plantation one time at night, and we were dropping off artillery shells, and we'd gotten them dropped off, and a special forces guy in a jeep came zooming up saying, "Hey, we're fixing to get mortared there, so you guys better get out of here." So we started taxiing immediately, went out to the runway, were trying to close up the back doors and get things squared away. We took off almost simultaneously with getting all of our doors closed, so
mm-hmm.
we were really eager to get off there. Flying into Khe Sanh was interesting. We had several missions in there, and that was, of course, one of the hottest places in the country at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But
was this during your 66-67 tour?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ever experience any major equipment failures besides that flat tire you talked about?
Let's see, we must have had flat tires a couple of times. I think it seems like we had an engine that wouldn't start one time.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a procedure where another 130 could pull up next to you, and you could use his engine to put air into your engine. It would let you start. It's called a buddy start. We did that a couple of times.
Okay.
I never had to do a runway where you go out on a runway and taxi fast and start an engine. Never had to do one of those. They call that a taxi windmill start, I think they call that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were always worried about maintenance and how to overcome issues that you might have that might have kept you from taking off. But in general, our equipment was very, very reliable, and we didn't had fire lights in flight a couple of times. Never any fires. They were all just false indications.
Mm-hmm. You must have had a good ground crew working on these planes.
I think we must have. I assumed that the airplane was going to fly, and when we'd get out there, engineer would check it over, and we carried our engineer with us, who was an expert in systems, and
mm-hmm.
and the things that happen, we generally were able to take care of them and proceed on.
Mm-hmm.
It was really important to us to get back to Saigon every day.
Right. I can imagine.
Yes. And we worked very hard to do that. And I guess we did do that most every day.
So after your 2 weeks, you go back to Cebu, and you were there for how long?
Well, they had a special R&R arrangement, so after you spent 2 weeks in country in Vietnam, you would fly back to Cebu, and then they'd let you go spend 3 days in a hotel in the town of Cebu, as opposed to in the tents on the on the airfield.
Okay.
So they'd send us to a hotel, and we'd go down and eat and drink and walk around in Cebu and sleep late and just in general relax for a couple, 3 days. Then we'd come back into the air base, and generally there was a training mission or two that we had to fly in order to keep drop current and keep airdrop current and keep low-level flying current, which we didn't really do when we were in country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd do a training flight or two, and then it'd be time to go back to Vietnam again.
So was it like two weeks in country, 2 weeks out? Was that about how it was, or was
that
it
was
more
about,
frequent?
That was about right. Occasionally, there'd be a mission to Okinawa or the Japan or or Korea or Clark Air Base or something. We might fly one of those too in the interim between the times we were over in country. But most of the flying was in country, in Vietnam.
Okay, Mr. Curry, you said that there were a couple other things that you. We just took a break, and so there are a couple other things that you did want to talk about your 66-67 tour. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the places that we went and some specific instances that I remember from those places. In the south, we made a couple of trips down to a little town on the coast called Vung Tau. And there was supposed to be a hot area in the delta at those times. There was a lot of combat activity in the delta.
Mm-hmm.
But Vung Tau was such a pretty place. I remember what a pretty place it was. It had a real nice beach there, and we stayed close to the beach. And you could see the soldiers and Vietnamese and everything having a good time on the beach. And nothing unusual happened while we were there, but it was a memorable time and an interesting place. We didn't fly. I didn't fly down over the delta very much. Mostly it was up in the north or mid-country to the north. And going down there was something we only did a couple of times, that we'd fly over all the rivers and see all the canals and rivers and everything crisscrossing down there. And it was really interesting to do that to us, because it was reminded us of the rivers that we saw sometimes in Mississippi and in the south, where there were a lot of rivers around pilot training bases, particularly in Georgia and South Georgia and South Alabama.
Did they give you different instructions as far as safety and things like that when you would go fly over the delta versus flying in the middle and northern part of the South Vietnam?
We really didn't see much intelligence. Our intelligence, mostly what we had, what little we had, would come from talking to the Army guys, who were generally always flying with us and who were much more in touch with the scene in the various parts of the country. We're always carrying Army guys around with us, and they would tell us what was going on in their particular place where we were. And so we got to know a little bit about the operations in those areas by talking to the Army guys that were with us.
Right.
We didn't fly much down south like that. We did fly a lot along the coast. We would typically make runs to Cameron Bay and stop at Nha Trang and Quanon and Da Nang and it was always fun to go into Da Nang. It was a real familiar base, but the weather was generally worse up there.
Really?
Further north you got. So I remember one time we were trying to get into Da Nang, and we were low on fuel, and we were always trying to fly visual, and the weather was bad, and we were flying off over the water and got pretty low, but we could see this big rock down on the coast south of Da Nang, and we knew if we came in by that rock on a certain heading parallel to the runway, we'd be right in the right place to land. So we came in, surrounded a rock, came in, got lined up in a runway, and they wouldn't let us land because they said they were instrument flight rules only, and we were VFR, so we weren't supposed to be able to land. So we had to go back and pick up a instrument vector and go back out over the water again and come back in, and we were short of fuel. We were really pressing for fuel. We were afraid we were going to flame out our engines before we got on the ground. And fortunately, we didn't. We got on the ground and got to taxi in before our engines quit. But always a little excitement because you were generally trying to fly as much as you could without refueling because it took extra time to do that.
Right. Did you refuel in the air or on the ground?
Always on the ground in this 130.
Okay. Now, why would they wave you off if you were making a perfectly fine approach there?
Well, it was just that was their rules. They said that you had to be an instrument under instrument control in order to land because the weather was bad. And we had found our way in, and we could have landed, but they waved us off. And I guess if I'd declared an emergency, I could have done that. But declaring an emergency was kind of one of those things you didn't do unless you were having mechanical difficulties. Unless you were really scared you were going to run out of fuel. And
right.
Generally, it had repercussions to doing it, so you didn't do it unless you really had to. And so they waved us off, and we said, well, I guess we can get out. And then we flew and flew and flew, it seemed like, on the instrument direction until we came back to the runway. We figured it moved like a short turn, but it turned out to be a long turn. I think the people on the ground liked to practice their instrument direction, so they didn't feel any hurry in doing that, and they didn't always get the chance to do it otherwise.
I guess they were also trying to make sure that if something had happened to your plane landing by visual, that they were kind of covering their butts.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I'm sure that's true.
Was there anything else on that tour that stands out in your mind?
Well, I remember landing the first time at a little field at night that was northwest of Quinan, which was on the coast. And this was a little landing strip called English. And it was at night, and they didn't have a lot of lights up there. And we were flying over the water to get up there, and so you saw a lot of boats out on the water, and it was clear sky. So the boats in the sky all looked alike. It was just totally black, and there was no horizons.
Wow.
So, you know, you could look at the boats and think it was the sky and think it was the boats. And for flying visually, it was really an interesting thing. So we landed on this little runway. It turned out the little runway was dirt, and it only had a couple of approach lights right on the end of the runway, a couple of blue lights. And we touched down, and the runway wasn't flat. We didn't realize that at the time. It had a real steep grade, so you went up this hill as you were landing, and then got to the top of the hill, and the runway went down the other side of the hill. So it was really weird runway.
How would you take off, going back down the hill on the other
side?
That
was a good question. We weren't sure how to do that, and it was too short, we thought, to go that way. So we went back to take off in the same direction that we landed after we dropped our cargo off. I don't remember what it was that night, likely ammo or something. And we took off, and it was considered a hot area, so we wanted to do our typical climb as quickly as we can, and we took off from, ran up our engines and taxied it in the runway and got all the runway we could get, and we were going up this hill, which was hard to get momentum when you're going up the hill, but we were reasonably light since we dropped our cargo off, and so we got all the engines up running and released the brakes and started going up that hill. Well, you were looking straight into the stars because of the hill. So we took off, finally got to a takeoff speed and lifted off just as we were getting to the crest of the hill, and there we were in the middle of the black and with no horizon, and we were going in a steep angle of attack in order to climb quickly, slow speed, close to stall, and it was really a nightmare as far as trying to keep your attitude and indicator in your head engaged with your instruments. Easy to get disoriented in that kind of condition.
Sounds like a really hairy experience.
It was quite a challenging experience. It's always good to have a good co-pilot when something like that's happening, because you've got four sets of eyes instead of just two on the instruments.
And right.
That was very helpful on that evening. Took off, climbed out, didn't have any problems, but it was a memorable event.
Mm-hmm. How would the co-pilot help you, and how would you keep your orientation in situations like that?
Well, the attitude indicator tells you exactly whether your wings are level, and mm-hmm. the airspeed indicator tells you you've got flying speed, so you want to make sure those are correct.
Okay.
And transition from watching the runway in the dark and with your runway, taxi with your runway lights, mm-hmm. into the black of the sky is always a difficult point to do, but you co-pilot would stay on instruments very closely. You'd watch as the pilot the visual scene outside, and as soon as I left it off, I turned it over to the co-pilot,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he was watching the instruments closely, so, and he
right.
just took right over. He had his hands on the column, on the control stick, so he just took right over and flew it out perfectly, just like I would have expected him to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you fly with the same crew most of the time?
Most of the time, we were flying with the same crew. It wasn't always true. But we had crew assignments, and that's generally how we did it. So
mm-hmm.
I had a young co-pilot from St. Louis that was flying with me. His name was Steve Lukfar, as I remember. I haven't ever seen him since.
Really?
Said he was going to go fly for the airlines when he got a chance. He's probably an airline pilot somewhere now.
Yeah. Tell me about the relationship that you formed with your crew members and the people in your unit.
Well, we all were doing the same thing, so we were pretty close. I don't remember much antagonism. When I would do something like make a hard landing, I'd get a lot of razzing from my engineer and co-pilot, but then the engineer would get out and check the airplane very thoroughly and make sure it was still in one piece and hadn't fallen apart or anything, and we'd go fly the next leg. And in helping the co-pilot learn how to fly, I'd turn things over to the co-pilot, let him fly around and make landings. And if he didn't do them right, he'd find out because they didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd, give him guidance. And I was on the stick so a little bit, so he couldn't tell it, but I wasn't going to let him crash.
Right.
But I'd let him go pretty far before I would interfere in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And he developed where he was really a good pilot. I was very proud of his skills and accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
And engineers and navigators were all helpful. We were going in and out of Khe Sanh on another memorable event where we landed after having trouble finding it. It was overcast and lots of clouds, and the clouds came in real low over Khe Sanh after we were there, and we didn't want to stay there because we figured we'd get mortared up there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in the mountains, and we couldn't, once we took off, we were in the clouds, we didn't know where the mountains were, so our navigator was very useful in that particular thing, as he could pick the mountains out on the radar, and so we finally got to where we'd take off and climb out as fast as we could, and he guided us through the mountain passes so we could get out of there without running into them, and he did it very successfully, so it was very much a crew-oriented team approach to flying there.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So were you flying blind that one time in the clouds?
Oh, yes.
Dodging mountains?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We hoped we were dodging mountains.
Okay.
Occasionally people ran into them, though. It was one of those things. We left a few airplanes on tops of mountains down there.
Mm-hmm.
It was lots worse at night, but it was totally in the clouds. You don't have much visibility if you're in total clouds.
That's right. That's right. How much did you keep up with what was going on back home in the United States? You talked about that a little bit before.
Really, really did not. Our families, in this particular tour, our families were back in the States, so we heard from some, but we did a lot of swapping of tapes at the time. It was interesting to make tapes and send tapes back and forth, which is one of the things we did. Little small reel tapes they were at the time. They weren't cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably still got some of those. I don't know if they better play. I probably don't have anything to play them on, even if I had them out somewhere.
Uh-huh.
But we we'd get mail when we got back to Cebu after being over in Vietnam. There'd generally be a letter or two, and that was about the essence of it. There was an Air Force newspaper we'd get once a week, mm-hmm. and generally we'd look for one of those and read a little bit about what was going on in the world, but didn't know a lot about it. You know, things were hot back in the States in the 60s, and we weren't very involved in things or even know much about them at all.
Mm-hmm. How would you judge the morale of the troops that were with you, your buddies there, your crew, and then your people in your unit?
Oh, I think it was all excellent. I look back at that as being a highlight of my military career, that flying. We were all very close together. We were working together as a team. It was really, really great. Mm-hmm. Great flying time. Everybody was highly qualified because they were doing it all the time.
Right, right. Do you keep in touch with any of those people?
No. Never have seen most of them since we left over there in 66. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I stayed over in the Philippines for another tour. It was not a C-130 tour, but I was flying on C-130s occasionally. I'd go over in country, but it was generally just over and back with somebody else flying. I was running aircrew coordination missions out of Clark Air Base.
Okay.
I spent 2 years there after I left Cebu.
Okay.
But I didn't really keep in touch with hardly anybody from that time frame.
Okay.
I did see a few later on in my career in the military. They were colonels by then, so was I. But no, I didn't keep much track of those folks.
Tell me about your next tour, 67 to 69. Was it your choice to stay over in Asia, or did you want to come home?
Well, it looked like it would be a fun thing to stay over there. I liked the arrangements at Clark Air Base,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it would be fun to live there, and it certainly was. The quarters up there were older quarters, but they were rambling and open to the air, and it was a tropical, desert-like environment, and it was just a fun, active place to be at the time. So
mm-hmm.
I thought it would be fun to station there, and my wife agreed, so she came over and joined me,
mm-hmm.
and we moved into a house off base for a while and then got quarters on Clark Air Base and stayed there. They had a lot of activities there. They had tennis and horseback riding and swimming, and there was a couple of resorts on the island of Luzon that we went to occasionally, one on the beach and one in the mountains, and
mm-hmm.
there was just a lot of fun things to do there.
Sounds like a pretty good tour.
It was an excellent tour.
What were your duties there specifically?
Well, there were a lot of aircraft flying back and forth to Vietnam, mm-hmm. going into country and some of them coming out for repairs, and we were part of the aircraft, what they called the aircraft delivery group at the time, and we would meet the aircraft at Clark and make sure they were fixed and ready to proceed to their next location, whether it was going easterbound or westbound.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of fighters that flew through there, a lot of small airplanes. Particularly, the Air Force had a Cessna Super Skymaster that had twin engines they were using for port air controller duties in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and they flew all those airplanes from the West Coast in large groups across the oceans to Vietnam, and typically there might be six or eight or of them in one group, and they would land at Clark in the last leg before they went over to Vietnam, and they had civilian pilots and extra fuel tanks so they could fly long distances, and we had to coordinate rescue aircraft on halfway across their locations to help them in case they had trouble. And had about 100 of them come through the year or two I was there. And it was an interesting assignment to learn how to operate aircraft and what aircraft needed and provide it and take care of the crews and anything that the crews needed to get and make sure they were briefed to go over in country. And it was a very busy time. I think I worked every day I was there.
Hmm. You're the operations officer.
Right.
Right. Okay. And so how many times did you actually get in country into Vietnam?
Well, I because of the combat pay thing, I got over there every month.
Okay.
You had to do that in order to get paid, and there were flights going back and forth all the time, so I would generally fly over there and generally come back in one day. I didn't spend many nights over there, occasionally, but not very many.
Mm-hmm.
I was needed back at my job in the Philippines, but flyover was part of being able to brief the people. It wasn't just to get paid. You had to brief the people who were going over there for the first time, and you needed to go over and make sure you knew how the thing is working. So
right.
I wasn't actually piloting. I was just a passenger when I would do that.
Okay. And these were in C-130s?
Yes, generally.
Okay.
Not always, but generally.
Okay. Did you miss flying?
I was flying... I was flying target missions in T-33s at the time in the Philippines. They took me out of the 130 since I wasn't in a 130 unit and let me fly with the people on the base. And we were flying the old T-33 like I had flown in basic pilot training.
Mm-hmm.
And we would fly target missions for their F-102s that were stationed there, their air defense fighters. So I'd get in the airplane and fly up off of the north coast of Luzon, sometimes go to Taiwan. And they would run up and make gunnery and rocket passes on me as a target, like I was the enemy coming.
Right.
Did that for 2 years. That was a fun job.
Mm-hmm.
Got back to flying single engine again.
Did you like that?
That was great. Flying out of my home place all the time. And
mm-hmm.
It was very different from flying a 130. You're up there by yourself in that airplane.
Right. Tell me about your attitudes toward the war at this point. This is 67, 68, 69, and the Tet Offensive happens in early 68. Can you tell me about that experience?
Well, I was over there, I guess, in 68 when the Tet Offensive kicked off.
Mm-hmm.
I think we might have been in Saigon or somewhere and just left. It was really a hairy experience. We lived by talking to the people who were more actively involved in it. I wasn't actually in danger anywhere or in any attack, but the people
right.
that we were flying around in our flights, the Army guys,
mm-hmm.
were definitely actively involved in the defense of several locations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a surprise that those kinds of things could have happened at that time.
Did you think that the United States was what General Westmoreland had said, they're on the way to see the light at the end of the tunnel, that the war was progressing, that the United States is winning, and then the Tet Offensive happens? Did your attitudes change at all?
Well, you know, I guess none of us ever really believed that, because the evidence that we were hearing was that there were people pouring in from the north and from all kinds of support and everything, and that we weren't doing anything really seriously about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just letting it go,
mm-hmm.
letting it come in and do things.
Mm-hmm.
I guess none of us ever really, not many of us probably ever really believed that that war was going well in any part of it, in any time period that I was there, particularly in the 67, 68 time period.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, why then the United States was kind of fighting this war in this halfway mode, as you've been describing it? Why do you think that was going on?
Well, I think, you know, they were, and at the time, we thought they were unnecessarily scared of Russia and our Chinese
mm-hmm.
interference. And we knew that was probably why, but most of us would discount that as being a possibility, and fighting war in a tentative fashion like that is just, we'd always been trained in our upbringing and our education that you wouldn't fight things in a tentative way. You did them to win.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons we thought all the military guys would be oriented that way, and so it must have been the civilians who were bringing this tentativeness to what we were doing, and as a result, we weren't very supportive of the civilian leaders at the time.
Mm-hmm. In your contact with other military personnel in this last tour when you're stationed at Clark, did you sense any change of morale in the American servicemen?
In that time, no, I don't think so. One of the things I would do at Clark frequently, I would meet airplanes that were people that were flying over to Vietnam, and there were several people that I had known at the academy. My friends and classmates did that, mm-hmm. and they'd fly through and things like B-25s headed over there, and you know, and several times we never heard from them again. They went over there and were shot down, and they were missing in action for years.
Right.
Nobody ever knew what happened to them again. That happened a number of times, and there were always sad occasions, but we didn't, you know, we didn't feel like, we felt like that was our job.
Right. Okay.
I lost a lot of classmates over there in those several years from 66 through 69. People that I knew real well.
Let me ask you some questions about your interactions and things that you witnessed among those servicemen. Did you ever witness any racial tension amongst the troops?
No, I had a loadmaster in my airplane who liked to fly the Confederate flag, which he did.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we'd land, he'd open the top hatch of the airplane and stick a Confederate flag at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought that was fine, and we had black loadmasters occasionally, and others, and our crew sometimes were black.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever thought that was strange at the time, and we never got any negative feedback from doing that. I guess I really didn't see any racial tension over there.
Okay.
There might have been cause. Nowadays, you wouldn't think of doing something like that, but.
Right.
At the time, it didn't seem like an issue at all. It was just something that you did, and
mm-hmm.
maybe people that would have objected to it didn't see fit to object at the time. I don't know, but it was not. It never got to be an issue.
Mm-hmm. How about any tension between folks who had enlisted and were officers, and then versus those who were drafted and did not choose to be there, but were there because of government?
I guess our crew must have been almost all too close together and had worked together too long. We didn't really see anything like that.
Okay.
You know, we worked so closely with our enlisted guys and mm-hmm. and them with us that we depended upon them and counted on them, and they did great jobs. And I didn't ever see any of that. I know it went on among, particularly among Army troops and troops in combat in the field, but we didn't see much of that.
How about alcohol and drug use? How prevalent was that?
Never saw any drug use whatsoever.
Okay.
Or even heard about any. Of course, everybody did a lot of drinking at the time. People were frequently inebriated when they weren't flying, but we weren't supposed to drink between 12 hours and flight. We were on 12-hour shifts, so really there wasn't much drinking going on in between that, unless we have a beer or two right after we landed, because we were due to go back and fly in 12 hours.
Right, right. Did you ever have contact with any of the indigenous forces of South Vietnam, the Vietnamese Air Force or the ARVN?
We'd carry them around some in our airplanes and land occasionally. There was some airplanes around, particularly in Nha Trang and Quy Nhon, some of the smaller locations. But other than that, no.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on your questionnaire about the question about encountering dangerous wildlife, and you put that you only had rats and snakes occasionally in your aircraft. Can you talk about that?
Well, a lot of the times when we would go to small locations, we would be picking up cargo that had been put on pallets and left out on the ground or somewhere in a warehouse perhaps, or small unenclosed place. And since it was dry frequently, it would have rats. It might have rats in it, and you had to be watchful for snakes and the same thing. And snakes would crawl up into your airplane, into your cargo, particularly in your wheel wells.
Mm-hmm.
I never actually saw a snake there, but people told me a lot of tales about them seeing them. I did see a couple of rats, and flying back from in country, it would get cold, and so they'd seek out where it was warm, and it was always warmest up in the cockpit. So we take off, you know, and it's hot, and we fly up at 25,000 feet where it's minus 60, and so whatever animals there that would seek out the heat, and the heat was up where we were, so we'd be flying at night, and there'd be a rat walking across the front of the cockpit.
Oh, gosh.
Right above the windscreen, because it's warmer up there.
Uh-huh. What would you do in those circumstances?
Well, we'd try to get it, and if we didn't, we'd generally have the aircraft fumigated. When we got to Clark or got where we were going, they didn't like to import those animals into other places.
Right.
Fumigate them in country, they could do that, too. Mm-hmm. They'd close the airplane up and put off a couple of bug bombs in it, or a couple of gas bombs of some kind to kill whatever it was we thought might be infected.
During this last tour, these 3 years, are there any incidents that stick out in your mind that you want to talk about?
Well, I wasn't over in country very much. Most of this time was spent in the Philippines. And,
right.
All the airplanes that we were operating or helping to fly into Vietnam, we saw our first C-130 gunship come through, and that was really an illumination to see those airplanes with all those guns sticking out the side of them when they'd always been cargo airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the first C-47 Goonie Birds that had guns sticking out the back. They were all highly classified airplanes at the time. And C-119s were flying through with guns, and a lot of transport gunships come through, and they were using a lot of those in country. That was very interesting. But that all happened after I was at Clark. I didn't go back in country that much after that.
Which airplane that you did see during those 3 years at Clark were you most impressed with?
Well, the F-4s were new at the time. We were most impressed with the performance of the F-4.
Mm-hmm.
It was a new fighter in those days and had tremendous engines and power, and that was just quite an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one time in Cebu, we saw a B-52 land. It had been over, and something had happened to it. They flew out of Guam, but they couldn't land at Clark, so they had a problem, so they came and landed in Cebu. And this air base was called Mactan Air Base. It's still there and active for the Philippine Air Force. But it's interesting to see the B-52s there in the Philippines. Didn't see very many of them.
Did you hear about their ability to deliver a lot of destruction to the ground?
We'd see it every time we'd fly.
Mm-hmm.
There would be great bomb craters frequently down below where things were, where they had been dropping bombs and just blown the whole countryside apart.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to fly, and we'd say, well, it looked like that's the moonscape because all the pockmarks and craters there.
Looking back at your entire Vietnam experience, how would you describe the enemy, the Viet Cong and the NVA? I know you didn't have any direct contact with them, but just in general, what are your impressions?
Well, they seem like they were very dedicated to their view, and not able to be turned aside by concerns or other kinds of issues. They must have been strong in their beliefs, so they wouldn't have been able to put up with all the bombing and killing that we did of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they we should have probably taken that into consideration or something. There's something there that, and it probably is the fact that South Vietnamese never had a government that was a real government. They had corrupt governments and people who were, you wouldn't want to have being your government, and so it's no surprise that they needed to fall. I'm not sure in retrospect whether they weren't better off after the North Vietnamese communists took them over than they were when they were there before.
Okay.
We give up freedom, but they had never been free and didn't understand that much about freedom. They knew they wanted it. They weren't going to get it from the communists, but they weren't getting it from the other people either. So it's just one of those things, the way you figure that out.
Mm-hmm. In 1969, did you transfer back to the States?
I did. I had taught while I was at the academy that I needed to go back to graduate school, and I landed an assignment back to graduate school, so it was time to go get out of flying and go back to other activities. So I went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base after that and spent 2 years in graduate school and 5 more years there at Wright-Patterson in the research and development business. So that was an excellent period too, but I guess that's beyond the scope of our discussion.
Well, we can talk a little bit to round out your military career. How long did it take you to get your master's?
I went back and got a master's in systems analysis, is what they called it. It was really operations research in the civilian fields, and I was what they offered me. We spent 3 months after I first got back, or three or four months, reviewing math and stuff, so we'd be able to handle the math in the actual program, and in 21 months of coursework, followed by writing a thesis on, I wrote a thesis on strategic attack of large bomber forces into Russia, which was a big issue at the time, and how to equip them with bombs and rockets and decoys and guns and defensive armament and things. It was fun, still an applicable issue, I suppose, in terms of the procedures used to do it. But it landed me a job over in the Air Force Logistics Command, where I studied, helped them develop computers for logistics support. And
this was at Wright-Patterson?
At Wright-Patterson. And they call that the Advanced Logistics System in the 70s. They were going to do that. And after I got done with that job, they decided to send me back to flying. It was one of those things where, you know, you at the time where you had to spend a certain amount of time actually flying airplanes. So I went from there to Little Rock Air Force Base and back to the training school for C-130s at the time.
Mm-hmm. How much did the airplane change since you'd been in it last?
It was the same airplane.
Okay.
They flew it a little differently. They had a different formation structure where they were flying formation in weather.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting to try to figure out how to do that. It was... they called it ski, or I forget what all that means. It meant flying airplanes with some kind of communication link and a CRT that showed you where the other airplane was. So you've kind of adjusted your flight to make sure you didn't get too close to them, although you couldn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
And you were flying, you know, about a mile apart, and it was pretty easy to. Occasionally, let you get too close.
Right.
In the weather again, like flying in the weather in Vietnam. But that was a good mission. I ended up in the training group as the deputy commander of the training group there.
What rank were you at this time?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Okay.
And we had just established the training group. It was a part of the training of the wing, and the other squadrons were not training squadrons. They had a couple of training squadrons, and they said, well, let's have a training group. So they established a training group, and I got to be their deputy commander and the first establishment of the 34th Tactical Training Group.
Okay.
And finished my tour there and went from there back into the NATO staff at Norfolk, Virginia, and spent 3 years writing a study of how to reinforce Europe up there. So we got to use my systems analysis degree and my ability to write. So I wrote this study with a couple other people, and we went and briefed it to the NATO staff in Brussels a couple of times, and worked with the SHAPE Technical Center in Holland and some of the people in Washington, D.C. and the Pentagon, and we wrote a big study, and after it was done, it was time to go do something else. So I said, well, I guess I've had 23 years. It's time to retire. So I hung up my gear and my uniforms and left the service after 23 years of commissioned service.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel getting out? Did you feel like it was really ready to get on? Or?
Well, they had decided, I guess the Air Force decided they didn't need my services anymore. I could have stayed. I had 4 or 5 more years I could have stayed, but things looked interesting on the outside, so I was looking around for jobs, and I found this ad that said, come to sunny South Florida, and so I sent them a resume, and they invited me down, and then they offered me a job, so I left the service and went to work for Pratt & Whitney Aircraft in West Palm Beach.
Okay.
And that was... that was the end of my tour in the military. But the education they gave me really served me well then and now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still working, and although I'm up in Huntsville, Alabama, I'm still working in the field, and
mm-hmm.
it's kept me employed all these years and been very, very useful.
Let's talk a little bit about your post-Vietnam experience.
Okay.
And some of your opinions about the war. When you came back in country in 1969, back to the United States, how many people talked to you about the war, asked you about what you had done and what was going on over there?
You know, I don't remember very much about that. I remember I was involved in school, and we were talking about other things. We didn't really talk that much about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember much conversation about it at all. It was still going on, of course, so it was in the news, and we were seeing it, and it was getting hotter and hotter. But the people that I was in school with didn't have the kind of background I had, and they hadn't flown there, so we didn't have a lot in common about that. And it just wasn't much of a subject. I don't remember talking about it much.
How about civilians? Were they interested in talking with you about it?
I didn't really like to talk about it. I don't really do much talking about it.
Why is that?
I don't like to watch movies about it either.
Really?
I have emotions about the things that happened over there, and I don't mm-hmm. I don't dredge those thoughts up much.
Okay. Well, if I can ask you then, why did you decide to talk to us?
Well, I think what you're doing is a useful thing. I've been reviewing a lot of history of Civil War things for
mm-hmm.
a family member that we recently heard had died in the Civil War, and there's a lot of recollections of Civil War in different collections around. I've been doing a lot of reading of that for the last few years, and
mm-hmm.
I think this is the same kind of thing. It might not be. It may turn out to be real useful someday. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. What did you think of American prosecution of the war once you got back? You know, this was when Nixon came in, and there was a lot more use of strategic air, and the bombing was intensified.
Well, that looked to me like the right thing to do. We should have been doing that the whole time.
Uh-huh.
And I was very supportive of his efforts, in taking the war to the north and not letting them get away with things, and
right.
I don't really remember why we quit doing that and let the North Vietnamese take over. I know it was important to get out of the war because of the uproar about the war, and people didn't want to have it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that all seemed right. It seemed right that we should get out of it. It didn't seem right that we should turn it over to the other people, but then we didn't plan to do that. That's just what happened.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any faith in the Vietnamization process of letting the South Vietnamese fight their own war? Did you think they were capable?
You know, I don't remember that. I guess I never thought they would be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, I guess they were not.
Do you remember how you felt in April 75 when the country fell?
Well, I remember thinking that was a terrible loss, but I remember thinking also it was important for us not to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I guess I was supportive of the idea that it was time for us to go do something else and not do that anymore. And if they couldn't do it themselves, then they needed to suffer the consequences.
Right. Okay. What about go ahead. I'm sorry.
Maybe I was convinced of that by the words from the president and his people about the need to get out of Vietnam, because I agreed with that. I thought
mm-hmm.
we needed to get out of Vietnam.
Do you think the United States achieved peace with honor, as Kissinger and Nixon did say?
I guess I would support that, yes.
Okay. Okay.
It wasn't peace. It was
right.
But it what had to be done, you know, and we gave them the opportunity to do what they could do, and it just turned out they couldn't do it. And I guess I could call that peace with honor.
Mm-hmm.
Peace for us, honor for us,
mm-hmm.
not so much for the Vietnamese. Well, it was peace with them, too. It just happened to be under the North.
Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned from the war, or did they?
Well, they were really hesitant to get involved in any kind of guerrilla war in other countries after that. I think that probably that lesson led President Bush the first time from not taking Saddam Hussein in Baghdad in the war in the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we would have been stuck with having to run the country and trying to do all these things, and I think caution probably led to that, and I supported that. I didn't think he should.
Mm-hmm. What about now?
Well, the situation's a little different now. I support our president and what he's put forth, and I think it would be easy for us to attack that country and make sure that they're not harboring any kind of aggressive intents anymore, and I think it's likely, looks like we're going to do that.
What are the lessons did the United States learn besides the caution and not get involved in some of these areas in the world?
Well, I think they learned that we need to have certain kinds of military capabilities, like precision weapons to hit things and make precise cuts. I think those things were learned and subsequently developed and now have come to fruition for us quite well. They learned the importance of communication, and so they worked a lot on communication capabilities, which have greatly improved. They learned a lot about joint operations between the Army and the Air Force and the Navy, which we see in effect now.
Yes.
They learned about the need for special purpose people to fight in urban terrain instead of just standing army kind of things, and that's come to pass. Special ops people mostly came out of the Vietnam experience. I think we learned a lot and have implemented those lessons.
Why do you think the civilian leadership did what it did or acted like it acted during the war?
You know, that's a good question. I think they were overconfident. I think they felt like they could control anything and make it go the way they wanted it to go. And that might have been true in the United States, but it certainly wasn't true over in other countries. I'm not sure it's true today. It'd be interesting to see what the results of our efforts in Iraq might be. We might not have any trouble at all taking over the country, but what we do with it once we get it, that's going to be a different matter. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yes, sir. Looking back at your personal experience in Vietnam, how do you feel? What do you think about your service today?
Well, I think I served honorably, and I enjoyed my tour in the military, and I value the associations and lessons that I learned there. I think they've served me well, and I would tell anybody, and have told others that same thing. I certainly have no regrets of doing that. That's I guess that's about all I could say about that. My son's currently in the Air Force.
Really?
He didn't join through me encouraging him. I guess he saw that it turned into a good life for me and said, well, I guess I can do that too. So he's been in for, I guess, about 11 years now. He's enlisted, and he's over in England at this current time.
How has the war most affected your life?
Well, you know, I guess it caused me to be over out of this country, over in other foreign environments, and to understand the people that I was around and know that there are other places like that in the world. It made more of an internationalist, perhaps, out of me than I would have been if I had stayed here in the country.
Right.
I think I know a lot about international relations and how it works and what one would be concerned about, and I wouldn't know that perhaps firsthand with as confident a feeling as I have now.
Mm-hmm.
sense, that makes me a better citizen in some ways, or more capable of evaluating the things that we are faced with, the decisions that we're faced with in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, you get to vote on some of those things, and most of them you don't.
Mm-hmm. Today, if you were to talk to a young person about Vietnam, what would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them that the important thing about Vietnam was that we felt that it was a threat to our country that needed to be met, and that we went over and tried to meet it in the way that seemed most appropriate at the time.
Mm-hmm.
it wasn't through any empire plans or visions that we did that. We were doing it because we thought it was over there, that we thought it was best for our country.
Mm-hmm.
It was supporting freedom for the South in a general way, but it was.
Mm-hmm.
We were fighting communism at the time, which was a terrible enemy for us. It probably wasn't so much for the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
since they didn't have freedom to begin with.
Right.
But I guess something along those lines would be appropriate to say to somebody today.
Okay. What do you think about Vietnam today?
Well, I'm impressed with its advancement. I guess that's one of the reasons I would say they're probably better off if the North Vietnamese won the war, because they had a government.
Mm-hmm.
The South was corrupt, and it wasn't... It's no telling what would have happened if they had been able to keep. It might have been more like Burma has become,
mm-hmm.
run by military strongmen, and there's certainly no freedom in Burma. Thailand's a little different. There's not as many military dictatorships around the world now as there used to be,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of them were taken over by the communists because they were so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them have improved. Vietnam today seems like it's on the path to joining the family of nations as a regular member.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly is not as bad, probably, as some of the countries in Africa. And things kind of evened out for them.
Do you agree with the United States opening up relations with them in 1995?
Absolutely. I think that's wonderful. So the more they can bring them into the world community, the better, the sooner. I have no problems with that at all. I think anybody that thinks much otherwise is probably just being short-sighted or vengeful. We certainly did that. The precedent is that we did it with Germany and Japan in World War II, so we shouldn't, and brought them, helped bring them into the world community as full participating members. There's no reason Vietnam should be any different.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever want to go back over?
Well, I think it would be fun. I don't have any fond memories of over there. It's just like anywhere else. I wouldn't mind going back to NATO staff headquarters either, but I probably will never do that.
Okay. Tell me about not seeing movies about Vietnam and that type of thing. Why don't you do that?
Well, you know, I just it's interesting that you'd pick up on that. I've told my wife that a number of times. I don't watch TV series about these kinds of things. I guess it's too close to home. I know, or too close to home. I know too many people who were killed over there, and that was an emotional scene. A lot of my friends crashed and are still there,
mm-hmm.
in pieces. And I just rather not think about that.
Have you actually seen any of the movies?
Well, I did. I watched Apocalypse Now and
mm-hmm.
some of the others. I didn't really watch the one about where the guys comes back with no legs and things like that. I don't. Mm-hmm. That's hard. Mm-hmm. Apocalypse Now, I probably didn't mind watching that. It was enough glorified. It didn't seem real.
Right.
In some senses, and the other ones, they were more real. Seemed more real to me. They were more. I didn't watch them.
Okay. How about books? Do you read about the war?
No.
Is that obviously that's by choice? Is it?
Well, I might if I found something that was interesting. I was recently found out about a series of books by a guy named W.B. Griffin. Or Griffith or something like that, who's wrote a bunch of books about things, and I'm sure the war in Vietnam is part of it, but I haven't read any about Vietnam itself. I read one that talks a little bit about actions in the early days in the 50s up in North Vietnam with the French. Mm-hmm. But I probably wouldn't discard a book like that. I'd probably read it if I was reading something about things, and would find it very exciting, and probably wouldn't get upset about reading it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I like to read stories about military, you know, novels about military stuff. I don't read a lot, but things I do read are generally Clancy novels and
mm-hmm.
Dan Brown, Dick Brown. This guy wrote Brown, I forget what his first name is. Anyway, he wrote a number of those kinds of novels, and they're very good. I've read a number of them.
Okay. Did your service in Vietnam or in Southeast Asia while you were there affect your religious beliefs at all?
Well, I have never thought about that. I don't think so. I was raised in the church, in the Protestant Methodist Church, and I'm very active in that church now. I always have been since the time I came to Ohio to Wright-Patterson. I used to go to chapel when I was in Mactan and in Okinawa occasionally, and I guess I've always been connected with religion, but I don't know that the war has changed or caused any modification of those things in my mind.
Have you ever been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
No, I've not. I haven't been on the mall in a long time. If I was ever up there, I would.
So you're not opposed to going to it, or?
No. No, I'd like to go. I just haven't ever been there and had that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about or add to our conversation today?
You know, I can't think of anything. I think we've covered a lot of territory, and I've enjoyed the opportunity to reminisce with you about these things. I'm sure I may think of other things I wish I had said, but I think we've done a good job.
Okay, great. Well, we'll go ahead and end the interview. This will end the interview with Mr. John Curry. Thank you, sir.
Richard, thank you very much.